You're listening to the Mindful Public Safety Podcast, hosted by the Center for Mindfulness and Public Safety, where you'll hear conversations and insights from public safety professionals and those who train and support them. To learn more about CMPS training programs, visit mindfulpublicsafety.org.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to another session on day 5 of the Global First Responder Resilience Summit. My name is Richard Gerling, and I'll be your co-host for this session. Today's theme is creating healthy agency cultures of resilience. And I'm going to welcome Lieutenant Jim Glennon to our conversation this morning. So, Jim, I'm going to read your bio, if you don't mind. I know it's kind of uncomfortable to have that happen sometimes. Just to give folks a kind of a starting point of kind of where you come from, and then we'll talk more about your story and how you got to where you are and the work that you're doing now. So Lieutenant Jim Glennon is a nationally recognized instructor, speaker, author, and owner of Caliber Press. For 30 years, he served with the Lombard, Illinois Police Department, where he retired at the rank of lieutenant. During his tenure, Jim was appointed the first commander of investigations in 1998 for the newly formed DuPage County Major Crimes Homicide Task Force. In addition to earning a BA in psychology and a master's degree in police management, Jim is a graduate of Northwestern University Staff and Command College, where he was elected class president. So, Jim, I know that there's a whole lot more to your bio. That's the one you provided us. So it's much more brief and pithy. So tell us a little bit about Jim Glennon, kind of where you started in law enforcement and a little bit about the arc of your journey to today.
Well, the county is actually DuPage, not DuPage, but that's funny because out by us, there's a Cafe DuPage, and we call it Cafe DuPage to make it sound like it's a little bit more than a sandwich shop. I'm actually the son of a Chicago cop, and he was the son of a Chicago cop, and all I ever wanted to do is be a Chicago cop. I remember when I was about 5-6 years old, my father literally put him in a squad car, putting his hat on me and let me drive around the block on his lap. This is well before seatbelt laws, things like that. So I guess, you know, I don't remember anything else that interested me throughout my life. Of course, I wanted to be a baseball or football player, but I lacked talent in both of those areas. So I went to college. And I was interested in psychology. I was interested in the way people worked. I took a couple classes in high school that really interested me. And so when I went to college, got the degree in psychology. After college, I took a year off and I did some volunteer work in the Appalachian Mountain area. Came back and started looking for a police job. And after a year, I Chicago wasn't hiring. So I was upset about that. But the girl I was dating at the time got me an application for Lombard, which is a town of 45,000 people, right outside of Chicago. It's about 12 miles outside of the Chicago area. But the area I live in has got 9 million people in it. So it's a big metropolitan area. DuPage is the second largest county right outside of Cook, which is Chicago. And that's got 32 towns in it. And my goal really was to stay there until Chicago opened up. I applied for the Secret Service, actually passed that test. But my third year on, they made me a detective, so I decided to stay. And 11th year on, I made sergeant. 14th, 15th year on, somewhere in that area, I made commander. And then I pretty much got to do whatever I wanted to do. I was our first sex crimes investigator, one of our first two arson investigators. I was in detectives about 40% of my career. I ran detectives for about 7 years. And then the task force, which is really and it was an amazing 7 years. I did that too. So I've been immersed in law enforcement my whole life. I've cared about officer safety since I first got on. I was always an advocate for that. I was in charge of use of force in our department for about 18 years. I was in martial arts. I took that for about 16 years until I just got too old and everything started breaking down on me. And then I brought in all the intermediate weapons, basically the defensive tactics and control tactics program. I was a C student in high school and college, but I just was fascinated by every aspect of law enforcement. And so I studied as much as I could. And As a boss, I started studying management. I got my master's degree in basically law enforcement justice administration. And the health of the people that worked for me was always important, not just during an event, but the 24/7 reality of living this job, because it can eat you up. It did me in a lot of ways. You know, I pushed my family to the side often. If I got a call that, hey, you know, LT, we got something going on 2 o'clock in the morning, I'm out there. I'm on a date with my wife. Boom, I left. And some of those were bad decisions.
Yeah. Thank you, Jim. What a rich career. And, you know, I know there's a lot of wisdom that that you offer, and we have limited time here. And so I want to kind of draw out some of that. You know, one of the things that you mentioned was this 24/7 reality of the job of a police officer. Can you frame that for us a little bit more?
Well, yeah. You know, I tell you, just to back up just a little bit, I started teaching back in 91. And so it's been 30 years for me. And the first thing I taught was defensive tactics. But I also taught a lot about communication. And I was a hostage negotiator. The only thing I brag about is I was really, 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 really good at getting confessions. And I could do that naturally to some level, but then I started to study it. And I've always been fascinated by the way the brain works, the conscious and the unconscious part of the brain. Well, that kind of bled into emotional health also. Because we make most of the decisions that we make during the day, like I always say 99%, and it's much higher than that, but no one knows the real number, is that 99% of the decisions you make during the day, you're making them unconsciously. You know, from steering the car to brushing your teeth to putting your keys down someplace. You know, I often say when you drive the car, is it the conscious part of your brain or the unconscious part of the brain? Well, it's the unconscious part of the brain mostly. Yeah, you know, and I always said, you ever drive to work, get out of the car, look back and go, how the hell did I get here? You can't remember the trip. So most of what we do unconsciously, which means we make decisions without really putting a whole lot of thought into them. And especially when you're younger, when you feel almost superhuman that nothing can happen. Like I was in Albuquerque last week, and there was about 300 in the class. And let me just go back. So at one point, Calvert Press saw me teach a management course for Northwestern and asked me to come on Calvert Press. Eventually, too long of a story, but my wife and my sister both got jobs with Calvert Press working out of their houses. Just as I retired, we had the chance to buy Calvert Press, and we bought it. Well, Calvert Press at that point had been around for about 30 years, and all they taught was street survival, which was great. It's cool. It's fantastic. And I was honored. But it was just basically how to survive a gunfight, how to survive maybe a shift. So when we bought the company, we expanded from just one class. Now we have like 25 different classes, and several of them focus specifically on health, mental, emotional, physical health. Because when I started to really study this stuff, back right when I bought the company, actually a couple of years before I bought the company, I asked a really simple question to bosses. Is officer safety important to you? And all the bosses go, yeah, very important. Yeah, my officer safety is very important. Well, I had two real simple questions for them that they, almost none of them could ever answer. And the first one was, how are they dying? And they would guess, well, you know, a lot happens in cars, and, you know, and then they get shot. And I said, okay, forget, that's great, but let's forget just on duty. What kills police officers during their career? How do they die before they retire? So, you know, our thing is in Illinois, 30 years is a big deal. And I was just shy of 30 years. Just because of the way my life worked out, I left a few months before that. So I used to call it the 24/7/30. Why do some police officers, a lot of police officers, too many police officers, not make it to 30 years? So when we looked at it, and I went to the CDC, the Census Bureau, every statistic I could find, and I had a few other instructors who were helping me with this. Well, we found that heart attacks and suicide kill police officers at a much, much higher rate than car accidents, roadway accidents, and felons killing police officers. So when you look at the statistics, and this is a lot of this is off the top of my head, but over the last 20 years, 10 years for sure, we average about 50 to 52 police officers a year being shot and killed by felons. And if you take 9/11 out, just take 9/11 out, you're looking at probably about 65 felonious deaths in the line of duty a year. You get about 160 die, traffic accidents, things like that, 9/11 disease. But feloniously, it's about 65-70. But when you look at the statistics, and they're hard to come by because they're not, none of these are solid stats. Somewhere in the area of 200 police officers will be killed with their own gun by their own hand. So that means you have a 3 to 4 times better chance of committing suicide than being shot by some felon on a call. And then there's a doctor, his name is John Sheinberg, down in Texas. He was also a police officer in Cedar Park. I'm not sure he's still in Cedar Park now. Talked to John several times. One of my instructors is a good friend of John's. And John's also a cardiologist. And he started looking at the statistics and he did studies. And his estimate is somewhere in the area of 150 to 200 police officers, and probably more, die of heart attacks, off duty every year. We have on average about 14 to 15 that die on duty. And I know that number is low because an Albuquerque police officer just died and he isn't on duty and isn't listed in the Officer Down Memorial page or anyplace else. So when you look at it, I always ask young police officers, those who just start in the profession, and I say, hey, listen, when you decide to be a police officer, how did your parents respond to that? And almost universally, they go, well, they're worried about my safety. It's because they're afraid you're going to get killed by some felon, right? Yeah. Well, tell them don't worry about it. The odds are you'll kill yourself before a felon kills you, you know, and they just kind of stare at you. But that's the truth. We dropped out of heart attacks. The average, and I'm going off a little bit, but just to give you a little background. According to the American Heart Association, the average person in the United States who has a heart attack is somewhere between 63 and 67 years old. The average police officer has their first heart attack. It's 47 to 49. And if they have a heart attack at 47, 49, their life expectancy is around 57 years old. So we do barely enough to provide the skill set in the mindset to overcome a felonious assault. Barely enough. It's almost a crime within law enforcement on how poorly we train our officers. It's even worse for preparing them to live this profession 24/7, 30 or 20 or whatever, how many years you want to go. So that's the foundation of what we started.
Yeah, really, really great. I guess we'd say really great data, sobering data. And the interesting thing is that, you know, we get beyond the statistics. These are real human beings, right? These are real men and women who dedicated their life to public safety and to serving their community. And there's a lot of suffering there for sure. Right. So today's conversation, today we're talking about healthy agency cultures of resilience. And so with respect to suicide and heart attack, cardiovascular disease, all those things that you were talking about, maybe illuminate a path forward, Jim. What, you know, let's talk about individuals and let's talk about agencies. Let's talk about the chiefs and the sheriffs, as well as the cops and the deputies. What do we do? Where do we go?
You know, I get that question asked all the time, and I wish I could tell you. I mean, there's certainly ideas. The first thing starts with awareness. And then coupled with that, you have to give a damn. It's the same thing happening with our military. I mean, our military is killing themselves at a rate of, I mean, how many a day? It's like every 3 hours or something. But I don't know the exact stat, but it's ridiculous that we ask these people to put their lives on the line to come back and we discard them. And people, no, that's not a headline. Nobody cares nobody does care. I mean, people who are related to these military personnel care. Their friends care. Same with law enforcement officers. But it's not a top story. I mean, look at Google. I mean, you'll find some stuff, but nobody cares. Nobody cares. I mean, the media, the activists, the politicians who have the platform for speaking to issues care more about a police officer on a horse who is using the reins to keep the horse at bay. That's the lead story that it has morphed into just the vision of slavery. And nobody got hurt. Police officers are killing themselves or dropping dead of heart attacks. No one cares. No one cares. If they did, they would do something. So the first thing is awareness. And number two is you got to care. So when I ask chiefs around the country, we have EAP and some peer support stuff. And that's great. That's great. But what's the culture of the organization? Because look at it this way. 85% of the police population are male. They're male. And I don't see that changing anytime soon. When I got out in 1980, so this is 40 years ago, it was about 13% female. Now it's 15% female. So it's male. And I ask the same question all the time. What do males suck at when it comes to their emotions? You know, and everybody starts laughing and the women go sharing them. So the things that we see, the tragedies that we experience, what do we do with these things? So I've been married now for about 17 years. This is my second wife. And my first wife, and we're all still friends and families are all together and stuff. But one of the things my wife said to me is, you know, tell me when things happen, I want you to share those emotions. And I'm a pretty emotional guy, and I yap a lot. In fact, I tell my wife I'm more of a stereotypical female than you are. I talk about feelings a lot. But I wasn't sharing what I came across on the job. And so one day I came home from dinner, which was rare. I was working 3/11 shift as a commander. And I found out that day that in roll call, one of my officers had lost her baby at 29 weeks and had to deliver that baby. We found out right at roll call. And it stunned all of us because this officer was very, very, it was loved by everybody else in the ship. I had about 18 police officers on my shift, 3 community service officers. And typical males, the first thing I do is look at 2 of my female officers and go, what do we do? Because all the men started pulling money out, literally. We'll buy her flowers. That's the male. Let us do something active to fix this problem. So roll call was very, very quiet that day. I had to make the announcement. Actually, I had one of my female officers make the announcement, which is, I can't remember why. Maybe she asked me to. I don't know. So I go out on the street immediately, really just to go up to like a 7-Eleven to get a Diet Coke. I was just going to do that and go back to the paperwork. And I had a sergeant working, a couple of sergeants working. And I get a call. The call comes out of a 18-month-old that was just hit by a car in the driveway. And I happened to be a block away. So I pull in. It was brutal. And there's the mother is holding this baby screaming. And I look up and there is a 16-year-old, 18-year-old girl, which I found out is the oldest sister. So the daughter of the woman screaming. And she's the one who backed the car over the little boy. So I walk up and I can see the skull is crushed. There's no hope. But the medic showed up right when I did because it was just a block away from one of our firehouses. And I literally am ripping the baby out of the mother's arms. Very, very emotional. So I go home for dinner a couple hours later. And again, a rare occurrence that you don't really know. And two of my daughters are sitting there, stepdaughters, my wife. And I start crying at the dinner table. And she goes, what happened? And I told them about my officer. And then I described what happened. And I have my head down as I'm doing it. I can, the tears coming down. about this little baby. And I look up and I see my wife and daughter's like this. You know, eyes wide, a lot of sclera, the white of the eyes are popping. And my daughter goes, how do you do this? Oh my God, how do you do this? She gets up and leaves the table. And I look at my wife and I go, this is why I don't share this stuff. The stuff that we see. How do you prepare a 20, 21, 22, 23-year-old officer for the things that we are going to come across? We come across things we didn't even know existed. I mean, I had to interview a guy who raped a six-month-old anal. Nobody prepared me for this. So what we wind up doing is eating this because we have no outlets other than other officers. So then we start to we lock in with other officers. We go off shift, we drink, we talk, and we make fun of everything and use a lot of foul language. And then we go home at 1 a.m. and we sit there and we stare at the ceiling and wonder why we can't go to sleep. You know, we experience massive amounts of adrenaline dumps in our career. Adrenaline dumps damage, what I've been told and read, is damages your cells when you're at a high stress level for too long or too often. Those cells regenerate. And the damage that is done regeneration. This is one of the reasons we age. But the average person probably has an adrenaline dump 2-3 times a year. You know, like my wife did. You know, she drives down the street, a kid runs in front of the car, she stops the car, she screams, gets out of the phone, oh my God, oh, I'm gonna have a heart attack. You know, and I'm sitting there, yeah, okay, did you hit him? No, okay, don't forget beer. You know, hang on. So, you know, she'll talk about that for weeks. Police officers don't even realize when they're having adrenaline dumps anymore because we live up here, right? Great book. Obviously, you probably have talked about this already, but Kevin Gilmartin, I believe he just updated Emotional Survival for Law Enforcement. And I've written two books. And I tell everybody, and I just told 300 people this, my book's here, buy my book about communication and our street survival update. Great books. But if you're going to only buy one book in your whole career, buy Kevin's book. And I asked, how many of you guys have read it? Hands go up. How many would recommend it? Hands go up. And I see a 24-year-old cop in front of me. And he said he read it and put his hand down. He didn't put it up when I said recommend. And I said, and I already knew he was 24. And I said, you wouldn't recommend? He goes, well, I only got halfway through it. I said, because you're 24. You're reading this thing going, it's not going to happen to me. And all the older cops start laughing. Because it's true. So we don't prepare these guys. And if you are having an episode, and interrupt me if you want. I mean, I have a tendency to go off and stuff. But, and I've talked to countless officers. I've been teaching nationally for 25 years. And I can't even begin to tell you how many officers have walked up to me, tough officers have walked up to me like on a break or something. Hey, you know, can I talk to you for a minute? You know, like, let's walk down here and talk to you. You know, real tough. And then they get down there and they lose it. Or guys go, hey, just you and I go to lunch. I want to talk to you about something. Boom, lose it. I went to lunch with a guy one time and he drove and we never left the car, never even ate. He cried the entire hour because they have nowhere to go with this. So if you are having an episode, what do? I mean, where do you go? So let's say best case scenario. And there are a lot of best case scenarios. You go to your sergeant and you say, look, I don't know what's going on with me, but the last month I'm depressed. I can't sleep. And I've actually thought life would be better if I was dead. You know, I don't believe in God anymore. Why would God let this happen? And these are all things that people have said to me and things I've thought. And you say to your sergeant, I'm really scared because I got a wife and a couple of kids and I'm thinking I'd be better off dead. That sergeant looks at this officer and says, look, we love you. I love you. Not only am I your boss, I'm your friend. We're going to get you help. We got a good program here. We got EAP. We got peer support. Go to the commander. Commander goes, I love you. You're not just a cog in the wheel here. We're going to take care of you. You got a good program. Go to the chief of police, sheriff. Yep, great program. We're going to take care of you. Going to keep you. Don't worry about money. Full duty. We're going to put you on light duty until you get over this thing. We can get you in counseling. Don't worry about it. And they mean it with the best of intentions. But then what are they going to take away from this officer immediately? His gun. Well, first off, how many police officers only own one gun, right? And two, now this officer is walking around the station without a gun on. And the first thought is, would you hurt your leg, hurt your knee, hurt your back? What's going on? Is that why you run light duty? How come you're not carrying your gun? You also know you can't do overtime. And, you know, you got little Johnny in, the basketball camp and little Sarah in volleyball camp. And you can't arrest anybody, so you're not going to get court time. And so literally your income while they're giving you full pay is going to go down about 35-40%. And you know your wife is going to look at you go, how are we going to do that? What are we going to cut? So the male brain, in too many cases, that's generalized, but I believe in this generalization. So I can eat this. I can handle this. So what do? We drink a little bit, maybe cheat on our wives. They give us a little bit of a bump. And then the shame and the spiral occurs, and pretty soon, boom, really quick, you're done. And if you're not putting a gun in your mouth, you're eating too much and stopping exercise, and your health is affected. It's a crazy, crazy ass job. I look at it now, it's an impossible job in many ways. So your question was, what's the answer? Awareness and caring. But now, what would be the mechanism to fix this problem, you know, in real life?
Yeah, Jim, you've done a really skillful job of framing the reality of what happens, the maladaptive behavior, the attitudes, you know, the succession of how occupational trauma shows up and what it does to the individual officer, to the families. So awareness and caring about it, right? Having a bit of investment. What are two things that you would recommend to chiefs and sheriffs that they do right now?
First thing, go to your politicians and tell them to get off camera and start committing financially. Invest in your police department. The thing that drives me nuts, and this does play into part of what we're talking about today, because I travel the country talking to people. And we did a poll last year, and we just did another poll. And only somewhere between 7 and 10% of the officers that are active right now would recommend this profession. And when we ask why, and we tell them you can check any of these and then write something to us, the two top things that we hear is, I don't get enough support from my own command and politicians and the way the media portrays us. That impacts the emotions of police officers. So these same politicians who get on camera when they, I don't want to get political. I don't. But the horse thing with the Border Patrol, if any of you doesn't know about this, but people coming across the border through some water, the horses are there to deter them. One of the Border Patrol agents has got his reins, and he's moving the reins around. That's to keep people away from his horse, not whipping people. But politicians, all the way up to the top politicians in the United States, have immediately condemned that officer or that agent for doing his or her job. Too often we have chiefs and politicians around the country, when a video comes out with no frame of reference and no facts, they jump to a conclusion, a political conclusion, a conclusion that will benefit them. And they say something like this. We're aghast at what we saw. This is not consistent with our values and training. And I'm like, no, you're out of your mind. It's perfectly consistent with your values and training, because you don't value training in any way, shape, or form. And the politicians who say, we're going to get to the bottom of this, and you see it all the time, are the exact same politicians who close up the purse strings whenever the police come and go, hey, listen, I need a hell of a lot more training for my officers to deal with the stuff on the street. And we have officers killing themselves and out of shape. We need we need money to develop some programs to protect these people. And then you get nothing but yawns. And then the cameras are turned off and the people with the purse strings walk away. So the first thing the chiefs have to do, because sheriffs are doing it. A lot of sheriffs are doing it because they're elected. But the chiefs work, you know, for the politicians. The chiefs have to go and say, let's look at what the reality is in law enforcement, and not the myths that are out there. So that's number one. And number two, make it a top priority when you invest. You know, what are you going to do? I've talked to some agencies that have really good programs, some very good peer support programs. I know one agency that every year, every year, the officers have to go in and talk to a clinical professional. And unless, and all the police in this agency were reluctant. Because what if I go and say I'm depressed? And they go, oh, well, if you're depressed, then the next step is suicide. We're taking a gun away. Nothing like that happens. Nothing like that happens. And unless they're absolutely, yeah, I'm going to go shoot myself tomorrow afternoon in a park, they won't do anything except, okay, this is where we're at. And no one finds out about this. And one of the officers there told me that when they first started doing this, everybody was against it. Now, most of them look forward to it. And if you want, it's free. You can call them and say, I want to come in, and they'll talk to you. And no one will know. It's not going in any kind of a record. Border Patrol has a really good, well, they did. I don't know how it's going now, but because they're so shorthanded, but a really, really good peer support program. I talked to several people who run that, but Border Patrol does have and has had for a while a suicide problem. So I think it starts at the beginning. So the chiefs, the two things is, you know, the chiefs have to go to the politicians and say, look, this is reality, and two, invest in these people and let's get some programs working.
So I want to be redundant because there's a couple of things that you've said that are really important to punctuate. The first thing is going back to cultivating awareness about these issues. You know, we talked about a lot of good data about sort of the landscape of suffering, as I often refer to it. You talked about the need to care about that. And one interesting thing, Jim, I found is that there's a lot of conversation around officer wellness, and it often feels like a checkbox. Like, of course I care. And you know, if we actually did care, we'd see action following that statement. So the actions following that statement really begin with funding. And so I want to just punctuate that. You talked about investing in training. But the other thing that you talked about too, which I'll frame maybe slightly differently, is investing in marketing. In advocating for the officers, advocating for the good work that's happening in the communities. And we can do all of those things and have accountability. There's no like mutually exclusive. We can't be accountable and invest in our people at the same time, because that tends to be where the conversation often goes. So funding and prioritizing the health of the officer. You described some peer support programs, and some psychotherapy approaches to things. So really, the whole health of the officer, really, we're talking about the physical health, the mental health, the spiritual health. I mean, and we could go on with different kinds of domains of health. So, and those are really critically important things. How we do those things, I'm sure, are going to be varied. With respect to the officers, the deputies, the agents, the other law enforcement officers out there, what are a couple of things that you'd recommend that they do?
Well, for officers, they have to, it's so funny because we have these conversations all the time. Officers have to take responsibility for themselves. They have to. But when you're 22, 23, 24, 25 years old, and, you know, you're in good shape, you know, you're not married yet, you don't have any kids, you know, sucking the life out of you, I know when I do the program, but we do a 2-day street survival program. And the second day, the second and third hours are dedicated to just this. And when I start these 2 hours, I go, look, there's going to be very few videos in these next 2 hours, because the Street Survival Program is incredibly dynamic. But these 2 hours, if we're talking about saving officers' lives, are the most important of the whole 2 days. But almost all of you under 30 years old are going to start looking at your phone in about 10 minutes because you think this doesn't apply to you. So, you know, I always pick some kid who's young and good shape. But you think you're going to look like this in, you know, 10 years, you know, get married, have some children, you know. You have to take responsibility. One other thing, I'm not in the best shape in the world. I mean, I'm 65, getting a knee replacement in a couple of weeks. But I've maintained that. My wife always makes fun of me because for the last 20 years, I'm trying to lose the same 15 pounds. But I've maintained this weight for a long time. I 4 to 5, 6 days, sometimes 7 days a week, I do some kind of cardio. About 4 days a week, I do just 15 to 20 minutes of weightlifting because of the things that I've read about. But one of the things that motivated me is almost everyone in my family, and I'm from a big family. I'm the oldest of nine. I have something like 40 nieces and nephews. I had a bunch of aunts and uncles. Virtually all of the ones that died early died because of alcohol or eating, their eating habits. I lost an uncle at 44. My grandfather, who I never met, died at 44. My other grandfather died when I was 11 months old. Uncles died. Two of my aunts died at 54. They were smokers. I was the oldest, so I couldn't stand watching these people die. It crushed me. I love my uncle died at 44, was only 9 years older than I was, and he was like an older brother. My youngest brother's 13 years younger than I am, so I was closer in age to Pat, my uncle Pat, than I am to my youngest brother Tim. In fact, three of my brothers are 10 years and younger. So I was so impacted by this, I actually had an adverse reaction to it. So when I had my second child, when I was 30, I went through a terrible period. I thought I was having a heart attack every day. I was having panic attacks. I was a sex crimes investigator at that point. I was a union rep at that point. We were going through our first contract. I was doing sex crimes. It was a brutal time, and I was petrified for some reason that I was going to die and leave my kids fatherless. Couldn't get out of my head. And then I had something called PVCs, which is premature ventricular contractions. And once I became aware of it, I could feel it. And every time I felt one, which is basically your heart skips a beat, which they're very benign, actually, I would freak out. So I wound up in a hospital twice thinking I had a heart attack. And so at 30, I finally found a decent counselor. I went to like two first ones, were terrible. That's another problem. Some of them just suck. They're just terrible. You know, my dad was an alcoholic, but he was not an abusive alcoholic at all. So that was the first thing that came up for the first two. And all they wanted to talk about is that. And I'm like, no. Then I found a guy who was great. And that's when I got into martial arts when I was 30, because I was always an athlete. I was an athlete, three sport athlete all through high school. And then a couple years in college, I played football. So I had stopped doing that when I had kids. And that fear pushed me back into this direction. So I pretty much watch what I eat, watch what I drink. I'm Irish. I have two bars in my house, but I never ever come home and have a drink by myself. I'm not saying there's anything wrong with that. I just never have done that. I'm a social drinker. my wife said to me the other day when I ordered egg whites, she goes, I hope I never order egg whites. And I go, look it. You've been with me this long. When I'm at home and when I'm with you, I try to eat healthy. So when I'm with everybody else and we're at a party, I don't have to worry about picking up a handful of chips. You know, so you got to learn this balance. But we live in an age where everything is immediate gratification. You know, and as I said, everything is affected by our emotional. Maybe I didn't say that, but our behavior is impacted by our emotional state. Our emotional state basically runs our lives. It does. It runs our lives, from the books we read, the people we hang with, the movies we see, the hobbies we have. We are emotional beings. Well, food is emotion, and it's biological. Biological, from an evolutionary biological standpoint, if you want to believe that, we eat as much as we can when we can because we don't know when we. Well, that still is ingrained in us, and then now because we have such good food, we become addicted to the rush of eating certain things, and I suffer with that constantly. Yesterday, my daughter was coming over for lunch, and she was stopping at a place called Portillo's, which is like a really good hot dog type, beef sandwiches, burgers, and all that. And I go, give me a Caesar salad with grilled chicken. She goes, really? I go, yeah. And she comes in with hot dogs for my wife and her and French fries. And I go, yeah, I'm immediately regretting the salad. So I have to. You have to fight through this. You have to learn how to balance it. But we don't teach that. We don't teach that. We should try to teach that. But I ask this question again. I'm going off a little bit, but I ask this question all the time, and I did it again the other day with 300 people in the room from all different agencies in New Mexico. I said, "How many of you have some kind of a program that requires you to do some physical fitness every year to prove you're in shape?" Maybe two departments out of all hands were. Bunch of hands went up for the state police, I think it was. And they went, "We got to do it every year." Great. How many people get fired for not passing that test? And they just laugh. It's a nobody. No.
Yeah.
So, and I'm not saying you should fire them, but we tried to get a program together. And I hear this all over the country. I'm pro union guy, but the unions fight this. You know, they fight it. And I'm like, but it's for the health of your guys. Yeah, but if one guy gets fired, that's not acceptable, so we're not going to do this. But if 50 die from heart attacks, you guys are okay. You know, so, well, that's a conundrum. And I had the same problem in my agency when I was in the union. They wanted to push it through, and I was all for it. But I had other union members going, "Oh, absolutely not. This is just a way to fire us all." They go, "What? Are you nuts?" You know. So anyways, we pushed it through, but it was voluntary. And I'm like, okay, that's cool. So we had a workout room in our agency. But one of the guys was going downstairs off duty, lifting weights, blew his shoulder off, put in workman's comp. They accepted it because he was doing it for something on duty. And then the agency immediately stopped the program.
That's
that bureaucratic mindset.
Yep. Well, bureaucracy is our enemy for sure. And that's, I think, one of our greatest challenges. We don't have a whole lot of time to talk about that. I want to wrap up. I want to summarize. There's this message from you that I'm hearing loud and clear, which is this message of accountability on both the individual law enforcement officer's part, but also on the leadership as well. And so I'd love to see if you can craft a message of hope for the men and women in law enforcement. You know, you come from this long line, this legacy of law enforcement officers, this legacy of warrior humanitarians. And so bring us some love, Jim. Bring us some hope. What do you say that can offer some hope?
Well, I think I can offer hope, but it takes me a second to get there because it's going to sound negative at first. But Denzel Washington is one of my favorite people on the planet. He's not just a fantastic actor, but he's an unbelievably great human being. In fact, over the last week, he said something about police and how great they are. But he gave a speech several years ago, I think in 2017 or something. I could be wrong about that. When he was receiving an achievement award. And he said something that I show this speech in my classes. And he says, "Ease is a greater threat to progress than hardship. Ease is a greater threat to progress than hardship." He says, "You fall down 7 times, get up 8. And basically what he's saying is this: it's up to you. It's up to you. If you're waiting for your agency to do it, you're a fool. Like I say to everybody, if you're in law enforcement, you should be in a boxing club or martial arts. You should be, for many reasons. It keeps you in shape. It gets you ready for a fight because your agencies will not get you ready for a fight. The average agency trains 4 hours a year. Only really, and the only reason is so you check a box in case you get sued and say, no, I did 15 knee strikes last year. You know, so I'm an expert. There's no procedural memory that we can teach. So we need bosses to actually be leaders. And there are a lot of very, very good leaders out there. And they need to understand, to be a good leader, you need to know your officers as individuals, not cogs in the wheel. Recognize when they're going through something, emotional or physical. Don't be afraid to go, "Hey, look it. I went through this at one point. You're putting on some weight there. I know you just had your second kid. Let me tell you what I just went through," like I just explained. And I told this to my guys all the time. I said, the story I just told you, I told my guys all the time. It is up to you, which is the great news. Because from a psychological standpoint, whatever is impacting you negatively, it impacts you negatively because of the value in your estimate of it. it that in and of itself can't control you. You control you. But one of the things that you can do is try to structure your life in a certain way. And my wife's very, very good at this, at letting me do this. She's not. I am. Before I go to bed at night, she knows what's going on in my head. I'm going to get up. I'm going to do this. I'm going to work out. I'm going to, you know, hit some golf balls, whatever I'm going to do for just myself. For just myself. I'm going to take an hour, hour and a half every day for just myself. And I know that's very, very difficult. It was very, very difficult when I was a young police officer with three small children. But I worked around. I had a health club that had a nursery, and my kids like to go to the nursery. Whatever it is, work that out. Make your mental and physical well-being an absolute priority. It's not selfish. And to me, and this is just me, the spiritual side is very, very important. Because that brings, I think that brings everything together. Never think of your mind and your body as being separate. And I think that glue is the spiritual, whatever that is for you. But if you look at yourself as a victim, that's a death knell for you. If you start looking at yourself as a victim. So I hope there was something positive in that, because I know it sounds a little negative at times too.
No, that's great. Well, Jim, it's been a real pleasure to chat with you. Thank you for normalizing occupational stress and trauma. I mean, some of the brief descriptions of your own experience, I think, give men and women permission to go, okay, wow, if Lieutenant Glennon experienced this and I'm experiencing this, there's nothing wrong with me. And so much of what we experience as law enforcement officers, we feel shame and blame and guilt because there's all of this judgment around it, and it's all normal. It's all absolutely normal. And I love your message of accountability, because it moves us away from that victim mindset to a growth mindset where we can actually do something. We can take an action to move toward recovery, toward healing, toward post-traumatic growth, and toward the continued leadership. Every single law enforcement officer is a leader, and they have a role, they have an impact. So, and you just reinforced all of that for folks. So thank you so much. Absolute pleasure to be here with you. And we appreciate your time today.
It was my honor. Thank you very much for asking me, and congratulations on what you guys are doing. It's very, 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 very important. Good job.
Thank you, Jim.
Thank you.
Thank you for listening to the Mindful Public Safety Podcast, hosted by the Center for Mindfulness and Public Safety. Video of these podcasts are also available. You'll find access information in the description. And learn more about CMPS training programs at mindfulpublicsafety.org. See you next time.